promised in our last study period, I'm following the statement I just lost track of in Jeremiah. It's in the 46th chapter, verses 13 to 26. Now, I won't take time to read all those verses, but we'll just pick out some of the main ones which tell the story. In verse 13, for instance, of Jeremiah 46, we read, "The word that the Lord spake to Jeremiah the prophet, how Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, should come and smite the land of Egypt." Verse 20, "Egypt is like a very fair heifer, but destruction cometh, it cometh out of the north." And finally, in verse 26, it says, "And I'll deliver them into the hand of those who seek their lives, and into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and into the hand of his servants, and afterwards it shall be inhabited as in the days of old, saith the Lord." This gives a very, very clear identification of Babylon being the king of the north. Now, in our last study period, we were checking from Daniel chapter 11 about the king of the south, or Egypt, and from Great Controversy Place 269, we have clear confirmation that the king of the south in 1798 was Revolutionary France. This had, of course, been Roman Catholic for centuries, but the time came with the mighty French Revolution ended Roman Catholic power in France and brought in instead the power of atheism and the power of licentiousness. So then, we can now come back to Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40 to identify the king of the north and the king of the south at this point of time. Well, having identified them, we can now begin to look at the history of what took place at that particular point of time. The king of the north, we've now determined, of course, is Babylon. In 1798, of course, Babylon was found centered in Rome, because the old Babylonian religion had been taken up by the Roman Catholic Church in a combination of those who had forsaken the Holy Covenant with, of course, the Romans themselves. Now, what event took place in 1798 between Revolutionary France as the King of the South and the papacy of the King of the North, which answered to the words, "At the time of the end shall the King of the South push at him." Him, of course, being the King of the North. And there was in 1798 just such an event, because General Berthier from France, from the French Revolutionaries, came down and took the Pope prisoner, carried him away from Rome into exile, where he very shortly died. And throughout the length and breadth of Europe, the cry went up that the papacy was finished and would never, ever rise again. Now, we know, of course, that Bible prophecy tells us that Great Babylon would rise again, and there would be the final manifestation of it and the final confrontation with it and the final victory over it. And so those folk back there, of course, who predicted the utter end of the papacy in 1798 did not understand Bible prophecy as far as they might have done. So that event is now past. The next part of the verse says, "And the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind." Now, against whom will the king of the north come like a whirlwind? Like the king of the south, with chariots and with horsemen, with many ships. "He shall enter also into the countries and shall overflow and pass over." Now, since 1798, what event answers to this verse? And the answer is none. It has not yet taken place. Well, people object and say, well, now, 1798 to 1980 is almost 200 years. It's only 18 years short of 200 years. Are you telling us that this single verse is covering a time span as long as that? It doesn't seem to suggest it in the verse itself. To answer the question, I turn to Revelation chapter 13. Revelation chapter 13, begin with verse 1, where I read these words, "And I stood upon the sand of the sea, and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns, and upon his head the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. And I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death." Let me pause right there. Is that an event in the past? Have one of those heads been wounded to death? Right when? Right, in 1798. It was at that very time when the king of the south made the push at the king of the north. Right then, let's read on this verse, and the next part says, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. Has that yet taken place? No, not yet. There has been a healing process. And you know, of course, when you are wounded by a knife or whatever else it might happen to be, the wound never heals up in a moment. There's a healing process that takes quite a deal of time before the wound has finally been completely covered in and there's no more injuries there. So likewise, for decades now, the Roman Catholic Church has been experiencing a healing process. And the healing is very advanced at the present time, but it is not yet complete. Not yet does all the world wonder after the beast. We certainly couldn't say, for instance, that atheistic Russia nor Islam is at the present time paying much respect to the beast as he rules from Rome. But that time is coming, of course, when these powers will pay full respect to the papacy. So in the middle of that verse in Revelation, we have a gap approaching now 200 years. The same gap exactly is back here in Daniel chapter 11 verse 40, because these two verses are obviously parallel. And therefore, when that time comes that the king of the north shall come against the king of the south like a whirlwind, then the deadly wound will have been healed, and then all the world will wonder after the beast. So Revelation chapter 13 verse 3 and Daniel chapter 11 verse 40 both have this quite long time gap in the middle of the verse. The words that we read here, the king of the north shall come against the king of the south like a whirlwind with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, would make us tend to interpret this to mean that there is going to be a military campaign on the part of the king of the north against the king of the south. Because back in those days, of course, we find that horsemen, chariots, many ships were the implements of war. And we tend to think, of course, straight away in terms of that meaning implements of war in these last days. But we have to realize that the nature of this final conflict is more spiritual than it is physical. Well, I'm saying, of course, in the last days, the Roman Catholic power will not use civil forces because they will when it comes to the actual execution of God's people. But by what means in the last days are the other nations brought under Roman Catholic power? It is not by the use of military force. Let's turn to Revelation chapter 13 to read some rather familiar verses in this particular chapter describing the way in which the final subjugation of all people will be achieved. Now let's start with verse 11 of Revelation 13. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. And he exercises all the power of the first beast before him, and causes the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. And he doeth great wonders, that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceiveth them that dwell upon the earth by the means of those miracles which he hath power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. Now this verse then tells us very plainly that it will be by the miracle working power of Satan that the nations of the world will be brought under the power of Rome. I'd like to turn to Great Controversy, page 553, where we read these words describing the commenting on the direct verse we just read. The verse in particular, of course, is Revelation 13, verse 13. He doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceiveth them that dwell upon the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do. No mere impostures are here foretold. Men are deceived by the miracles which Satan's agents have power to do, not which they pretend to do. So they'll be very real miracles, supernatural sights. Now on page 624, we find that this whole thing is even more plainly brought to view as follows. Fearful sights of a supernatural character will soon be revealed in the heavens in token of the power of miracle-working demons. The spirits of devils will go forth to the kings of the earth and to the whole world to fasten them in deception and urge them on to unite with Satan in his last struggle against the government of heaven. By these agencies, rulers and subjects will be alike deceived. Persons will arise pretending to be Christ himself and claiming the title and worship which belongs to the world's Redeemer. They will perform wonderful miracles of healing and will profess to have revelations from heaven contradicting the testimony of the Scripture. Now, Scripture must interpret Scripture, and therefore we must be careful not to form our ideas about what chariots and horsemen and many ships actually mean. In Daniel, of course, we're plainly told it'll be by the use of chariots, horsemen, and many ships that the king of the north will overflow the king of the south and come into possession of all his territories. When we turn to Revelation chapter 13 and these statements in the great controversy, what are we told in these references is the means that will be used to bring about this triumph of Babylon over the nations. And the answer is miracles, supernatural works. Let's think for a moment about the expression that he will bring fire down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. We know that in the last days, Satan is going to counterfeit the mighty work of the gospel. Let's turn back to page 464 in Great Controversy to give us a very clear confirmation of this fact. Great Controversy, page 464. I've always found this to be a very helpful statement. It reads as follows. Notwithstanding the widespread declension of faith and piety, there are true followers of Christ in these churches. Reference being made, of course, to the fallen Protestant churches. Before the final visitation of God's judgments upon the earth, there will be among the people of the Lord such a revival of primitive godliness as has not been witnessed since apostolic time. The Spirit and power of God will be poured out upon his children. At that time, many will separate themselves from those churches in which the love of this world has supplanted love for God and his people. Love for God and his word. Many, both the ministers and people, will gladly accept those great truths which God has caused to be proclaimed at this time to prepare a people for the Lord's second coming. Right. So here we find a description given us of the mighty work of the loud cry when it descends upon the people of God and empowers them to finish the work and cut it short in righteousness. Let's put some of these facts on the board right now then. Here we have the great day when the true latter rain will bring about the loud cry. The latter rain is the power, and the loud cry, of course, is the resulting message. Now, the latter rain will be the antitype of the former rain, which took place, of course, back in the days when they met there at Pentecost and prayed for the mighty outpouring of God's Spirit. Now, in the days of Pentecost, what came down from heaven in the sight of men? Right, fire came down from heaven in the sight of men. And it was the first time in history that the manifestation of the spirits came upon men in this particular way. And Satan apparently was caught very much by surprise by this manifestation of God's power. Now, the whole world today, the whole religious world, is looking forward with great expectation to the coming of the latter rain. Now, I haven't read anywhere in the Word of God that maybe you have, and if you have, I'd be glad to see the statement, that we're going to be meeting in an upper room, and once again there's going to come a visible manifestation of fire descending upon God's people. Now, it could be that way, and we can very well expect it too, because of the anticipation that's given to us by Pentecost. But whether it will or will not happen that way, what does the world expect to happen? The same thing. Now there's coming a counterfeit loud rain and loud cry, which will precede the coming of the real one. I'll read this now as I continue in the same paragraph on page 464. The enemy of souls desires to hinder this work. Now what work? The work of the latter rain and the loud cry, which was just described in the paragraph above. And now note these next four or five words. And before the time for such a movement shall come, he will endeavor to prevent it by introducing a counterfeit. Now it's very obvious, of course, that the two words of it are understood in this connection. In other words, it says the enemy of souls desires to hinder this work, and before the time for such a movement shall come, he will endeavor to prevent that movement by introducing a counterfeit of that movement. Now I've added a few words there, but would you agree that the words I've added only give the true sense to that sentence? Doesn't it? Right? In very clear terms. So where then will the false latter rain be located? It says plainly before the true. So here we have the false or counterfeit latter rain which comes before the true latter rain and loud cry. Very good. Now then, it will be expected that when this thing, of course to a certain extent that false latter rain is already here, but they will expect, and Satan of course will provide, fire which will come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. When that comes down, of course, every man, from the least to the greatest, will be tremendously impressed, and by such supernatural manifestations, which extend throughout the length and breadth of the entire world, Satan will bring the whole world under the command of the King of the North. And atheism is going down. And of course, at the present time, Islam, which is a very strong section of the atheistic world, is very, very resurgent and very, very belligerent and active and even evangelistic. I was interested to read, and of course they expect that they're going to sweep the entire world with this wonder religion, Islam. When you look at the Islamic lands, and it's been my experience to travel through those various countries, landing mainly at the airports on my way to Europe, or home from Europe. But I did spend a few days once in Egypt, which is an Islamic country. And believe you me, if their religion is a true religion, I'm sure I don't want it, because it is a desolator. The people are poor, for the most part, and they did not have by any means the intellectual and cultural attainments of those nations which have been under the shadow of Protestantism. But just the same, they believe that a resurgent Islam is going to sweep the world as it did back in the days of Muhammad, the founder of it, and this time, within a few years, even the whole of North America, said one of these Islamics a few days ago, is going to become Mohammedan, or followers of Islam. But that is not what Bible prophecy teaches. On the contrary, we're told that the King of the South, of which Islam is very much a part, will become totally subjected to the mighty power of the King of the North. Let's read again the last part of verse 40, where it says, "And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over." Now verse 41, "He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon." Now you'll notice I dropped the word countries. The actual authorized version says, "And many countries shall be overthrown." If you happen to have a Bible in which the words are italicized, you find the word countries to be italicized. And if you have a revised standard version, you find it reads, "And tens of thousands shall fall." Right? Anybody with a revised standard version? You find if you have it says, "And tens of thousands shall fall," rather than to use the word "many countries." Now then, in this verse we have no fewer than four geographical areas mentioned. Let's place them before our eyes up here on the blackboard now. Well, whiteboard, thank you very much, your illustration board. First of all, we have the glorious land, right? Next of all, we have Edom and Moab and
the chief of the children of Ammon.
Four geographical areas. Now, three of them have something very much in common with Babylon, as Babylon is today. And what is that thing in common? They just don't exist anymore. You can't today find a race of people called Babylonians. I mean, physical, national Babylonians, can you? And neither can you find a race of people called Edomites, nor can you find any more Moabites, neither can you find Ammonites. They've vanished off the face of the earth. As you probably know, of course, the Edomites were the children of whom? Esau. And the Ammonites and the Moabites were respectively the children of whom? Who? Lot. Right? They were the children of Lot and his incestuous daughters. Recall how those young women decided they had no marriage opportunities, and of course back in those days the most important thing to a girl was to have a baby, to have offspring. And they decided to make their father drunk with wine and have him be the father of their children. And so Ammon and Moab were born that way, and they grew up to be deadly enemies of the children of Israel, as in fact the Edomites were too. Now the Edomites hacked themselves a city out of rock in a place called Petra, which is sort of down south of the Dead Sea, I believe. And the rock down there is very red, and you may have seen in some Adventist evangelistic campaigns some rather striking photographs of the rock red city of Petra. And that's when the Edomites retired and earned their living down there, but they disappeared off the face of the earth, and there are no Edomites living on the earth at the present time. And likewise, the Moabites and the Ammonites have also disappeared. Now, this means, then, that if we're going to use a geographical method of interpretation in regard to identifying who Edom, Moab, and Ammon are, where do we find ourselves? Lost, right? We just can't do it, because there's no land and no people by that name today. It just doesn't exist anymore. Now, if in the case of three of them, we are forced to use other than geography is our identifying factor, then can we consistently use geography for the last one simply because there is still a land of Palestine? We can't, can we? What is true of three most certainly must be true of the fourth. And here we have, of course, the biblical three witnesses. If it was the other way about, we might have an argument, but here God has really made the point plain by putting into one single verse four geographical locations, three of which don't exist as geographical locations anymore. So this means, of course, that we must find then the counterparts of these things in the spiritual sense of the word. Now, let's look first of all at the land of Israel, or the pleasant land, the glorious land rather. Now, originally, and we must go back, of course, to what was the glorious land originally. What was the glorious land? It was Israel. And who is Israel in these last days? God's professed people. And therefore, in particular, it must refer to God's chosen people, and that is the Seventh-day Adventist Church. We looked at the prophecy of Daniel 8 and 9. Was it this morning, I believe, or was it yesterday afternoon? Yesterday afternoon, I think, yes. And we traced the introduction of stones from Rome into the modern temple structure of the Adventist organization. Now, we want to ask ourselves the question, is this a prophecy of the future? In other words, is the King of the North yet to enter into the Seventh-day Adventist Church, bringing about the fall of tens of thousands of people, or has this already happened? It's already happened, as is very, very clearly evident. And we won't trouble to make a list tonight, as we might make, of course, of the various elements of Romanism which have entered into the glorious land. But let's take one just very, very briefly in passing, and that is the organizational structure that you find in the Catholic Church and also in the Adventist Church. Now, we made the point this morning that when a church takes away the daily from the people, they take away Jesus Christ as the head of every man in the church. And who do they put in the place of Christ? Man. Or, to get away from people seeing that, they put the church in the place of Jesus Christ, which, of course, in reality is put man in the place of Jesus Christ. Now, whenever you find a church with an organizational structure where man takes the place of God, then you have a church into which the king of the north has entered. Now, in making the church the objective, then, of course, everything is for the church. And anyone who leaves the church is a traitor to the church. When you're baptized, of course, all your promises are to the church and not to Jesus Christ. You pay tithe to the church. You respect the name of the church. And the church is the end, the God, the last word in the whole situation. Now, when a person becomes so married to the church that the church is his authority, the church is his head, and he obeys what the church says, then when the truth of God comes to that person, what hope does that person have of seeing and following that truth? None at all. And the obvious result of that unfortunate situation is that tens of thousands shall fall from where? From the truth. And we've seen, of course, that when the glorious light of the 1888 message came to the Seventh Adventist Church, of the 2 million, between 2 and 3 million Adventists, by far the greater majority failed to accept that message, and they fell from divine favor into a state of rejection and apostasy. But now, at the same time, as we're told that tens of thousands would fall, we're told that the Edomites and the Moabites and the chief of the children of Ammon would escape out of his hands. Now, who can these folk be at the present time? Who are the modern Edomites, Ammonites, and Moabites? Now, the answer is not hard to find. First of all, we ask ourselves the question, apart from the Seventh-day Adventists, because these obviously cannot be Seventh-day Adventists, because the glorious land symbolizes them, apart from the Seventh-day Adventists, in the last days, from whence will come a great number of people who will not identify themselves with the King of the North? From whence will they come? From the Protestant churches, and from the world, and even from the Roman Catholic Church, but particularly from the Protestant churches. You know the statement on page 390, I think it is, or 390, of the book Great Controversy, where Sister White says that the greater proportion of God's true followers. Here is the actual statement, page 319. Notwithstanding the spiritual darkness and alienation from God that exists in the churches which constitute Babylon, the great body of Christ's true followers are still to be found in their communion. There are many of these who have never seen the special truths for this time. Not a few are dissatisfied with their present condition and are longing for clearer light. They look in vain for the image of Christ in the churches with which they are connected. As these bodies depart further and further from the truth and ally themselves more closely with the world, the difference between the two classes will widen and it will finally result in separation. The time will come when those who love God supremely can no longer remain in connection with such as are lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying the power thereof. Now, a little further down on the same page, when those that believe not the truth of their present unrighteousness shall be left to receive strong delusion and to believe a lie, then the light of truth will shine upon all whose hearts are open to receive it, and all the children of the Lord that remain in Babylon will heed the call, "Come out of her, my people." And as you remember on page 465 I read previously, at that time, that is when the loud cry goes forward, many will separate themselves from those churches in which the love of this world has supplanted love for God and His Word. Many, both the ministers, and they are the chief of the children of Ammon, the ministers and people, will gladly accept those great truths which God has caused to be proclaimed at this time to prepare a people for the Lord's second coming. And get over and pray 604. We find these words, that God still has a people in Babylon, and before the visitation of His judgment, these faithful ones must be called out that they partake not of her sins and receive not of her plagues. So Daniel chapter 11 tells us about Edomites, Moabites, and Ammonites escaping from Babylon. And the Spirit of Prophecy tells us about a great number of Protestant people in particular, both ministers and people who will come out of Babylon in response to the call, "Come out of her, my people." So then who must the Edomites, the Moabites, the Ammonites obviously represent? Right? Those Protestants who escape from Babylon before her plagues fall upon them. Now, let's now check the appropriateness of these symbols. We'll come back first of all and we'll look at the situation so far as Edom is concerned. And we saw previously, of course, that we have Isaac. And Isaac was the father of two sons. Their names, of course, were Esau and Jacob. Now, Esau, of course, became the father of the Edomites, and Jacob became the father of the Israelites. Now, coming over the other side of the question, of course, we have Abraham, A for Abraham, and we have Lot. And Abraham, of course, gave birth to Isaac, and Isaac gave birth to Jacob, whereas Lot, who is a very, very close relative, gave birth, or fathered, the two sons, Ammon and Moab. So the point I'm making is this, that Edom and Ammon and Moab have a very, very close physical descent with the children of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, which were the Israelites, of course. Now, even though they had a common descent or a common fatherhood, because the Ammonites could say that Lot was their father and he was a very close relative of Abraham, and the Edomites could say with the Israelites, well, we have Isaac and Abraham for our father, the same as you do, yet they were bitter enemies. And the Ammonites, the Edomites, and the Moabites always fought with great hostility and vigor against the Israelites and gave them a continual amount of trouble. Now, what was physical in those relationships back then must be spiritual in the relationship of the modern Edomites, Moabites, and Ammonites with modern Israel. And so we ask ourselves a simple question, going back into history, what churches have a very close original starting point with Seventh-day Adventists? And the answer is Protestants. Don't we share a common heritage? Don't we and they both trace our descent back to the Middle Ages, to Luther and Huss and Jerome and Wycliffe and Melanchthon and so forth? Certainly we do. But over the years, especially since Adventism was born, and when Adventism was on the right track, whom did Adventists find to be their most bitter enemy? Protestants, right. And it's from those who have been Adventists' most bitter enemies that there will come many in these last days, both ministers and people. In other words, Edomites, Moabites, and the chief of the children of Ammon, that escape out of the hand of the Roman Catholic power of Babylon the Great, and they will fully and completely identify themselves with God's true people in the last days. At the present time, they are out there. They're serving God the best that they know. They're becoming increasingly distressed by the apostasy and the immorality and the licentiousness and the rejection of God's truth which they're witnessing in the churches where they find themselves. And more they are questioning the authority of their churches. And they are being prepared today to receive the message which you are being prepared to give. And while at the present time, of course, we may feel that the gospel work makes but little progress, we see so few extra folk come in from year to year, we're not to be distressed by that, because that's exactly what is prophesied. Back in the days when the parable of the 10 virgins was fulfilled for the first time, during the time that led up to the midnight cry, in other words, between 1833 and 1844, only hundreds of people were found as coming into and staying with the Advent movement. There were, of course, many people who came in and went out again. That always happened. It's right down through history, it's always happened. But those who really stuck to it, there are only a few hundred. So the result of preaching through 11 years only brought in a matter of hundreds. And then in 2.5 months, 50,000 people came in. What an inrush of souls that was. 50,000 people in the short space of 2.5 months. Now, we've spent, I suppose, something like 20 years, more or less, 25 years, in the proclamation of this message. And around the world, we can only number our groups in hundreds. We can't say we've got thousands of people, In fact, I doubt if we even have 1,000 people worldwide. But those 1,000 folk are strategically placed, more or less, by God's directions. And when the mighty power of the loud cry comes, then there is going to be a tremendous influx of folk from the Babylonian churches and from the Adventist church too. And, of course, there'll be Roman Catholics who will join the ranks of God's people. There'll be atheists, there'll be Islamics, there'll be communists, there'll be every kind of religion will come in and take their place with God's folk in these last days. And it will be a tremendous time, but don't become too excited when you see thousands being converted today, because when the great final test comes, the majority of those are going to lose their faith and take a final and irretrievable stand with Babylon in the end. Then move on to verse 42, having covered verse 41. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall bear his steps. Now this verse, of course, most definitely prefigures or prestates a total conquest on the part of the Babylonian power. Egypt shall not escape. And the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be his steps. And the Libyans, of course, were the western, and still are, the western power from Egypt. And Ethiopia, of course, is the eastern power. So it bespeaks, of course, not just the great large atheistic area, which, of course, is Russia, will come under papal power, but the lesser centers of atheism, such as Islam, for instance, and heathenism, for instance, will likewise be incorporated in this grand system. At the present time, of course, we find that the Islamics and the Russians are very hostile to each other, especially since the invasion of Afghanistan. But the time will come when they will turn their attention from each other and both give their allegiance to the Roman Catholic or papal system, and thus Rome will rule the entire world. Let's turn for further confirmation of this to Revelation 13 and verse 8. Well, we read first of all, of course, from Revelation 13 and verse 3, which says, "And all the world wondered after the beast." And then in verse 8, where it says, "And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him, whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world." I like the use of the word world back in verse 3, which says, "And all the world wondered after the beast." Now, there'll be Christians in the world at that time, but they'll not be of the world nor part of the world, and so therefore the word of God could not say that every person is not the world. And so in verse 8 that distinction is made, which says, "All that dwell upon the earth." Now, all that dwell upon the earth will be more than the world, because Christians, while they dwell upon the earth, are not of the world, are they? Right then, so then those dwellers upon the earth apart from the world are those whose names are found written in the Lamb's Book of Life, and of course most certainly they will not bow down and worship the beast and his image at that point of time, but everybody else will. Now of course if you went to a person in Iran today, a devout Islamic, and said to him, "It's not very long now when you're going to be a Roman Catholic bowing down to the Pope of Rome," what would he do? He'd spit in your face, wouldn't he? Or cut your throat, perhaps. In short, he'd be so indignant at such a suggestion, he'd reject it. But even though he rejects that suggestion, he will do it, unless in the meantime, of course, he becomes a true child of God. And so in Daniel chapter 11, we're given the picture of the entire world coming under the power of Babylon. It will be the grandest and the most wonderful confederacy of forces that Satan has ever been able to put under his command. And of course he'll go forth this final battle very, very confident that he will be the victor in this final struggle. And when it comes to numbers power, of course, and money power, he would have very good reason to feel that way. Whereas in fact, of course, it takes more than that to win that final war. Tomorrow we go on to take the last two verses of the chapter, verses 44 and 45, before moving to Daniel chapter 12. But as for this evening, our time is gone, so we'll have to stop at this point.